The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
India has reported the world's highest daily count of new coronavirus cases for a second straight day. More than 330,000 new infections were recorded in the last 24 hours there. In response, Canada is banning all flights from both India and Pakistan, and the UK is also putting new restrictions on travel to and from India.
Studies show that markets generally don't rise or fall based only on the capital gains tax rate, but a tax hike, especially a doubling of that top rate that Biden's talking about, could result in a large amount of selling, at least in the short term. Who is most affected? Well, it only applies to a very small slice of people with 1 million or more in income. So that's about the top 0.3%, around a half million tax filers.
Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies had a wild ride on Friday. That on fears that US President Joe Biden plans to almost double capital gains taxes. Bitcoin slumped as much as 7% before bouncing back. That took it close to $48,000 at one point and marked the first time it's been below $50,000 since early March.
For 60 years, 50 states, but Congress is now one step closer to adding another. The House passing a bill that would make Washington, District of Columbia, the state of Washington Douglas Commonwealth, honoring abolitionist Frederick Douglass. The mayor would become the new governor, and the 700,000 plus people living in D.C. would get federal voting rights, including two new senators. That would almost certainly mean two more Democrats, given D.C.'s political leanings, with the GOP intensely opposed to statehood.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks reacting negatively this week to news the Biden administration may raise capital gains to 44% from 20% for upper-income Americans. In addition, there's a proposal to add a surtax to all security transactions. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up next, Mark Nelson will be joining me on the program from Radiant Energy Fund. He did all the research on Michael Schellenberger's new book called Apocalypse Never. You're going to want to understand why the world is not going to end in the next 10 years, and what are the implications for green energy going forward? Where is all that electricity going to come from to power these EVs? So we'll be talking with Mark on that. Later on in the big picture, Chris Sheridan and I are going to talk about two key themes that we see in this next decade, the return of inflation and the bull market of the century. I'm talking specifically about commodities. I don't care if it's gold, silver, to copper and nickel, or even oil. We see a bull market unlike anything we've seen in the past. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Not a lot going on this week for the financial markets, but a few things to note off the top. After a 7% rise in the S&P 500 in the previous weeks, this week was about consolidation. The majority of earnings reports were strong, economic news was light, and didn't come in until the end of the week. So let's just focus right there right now. New home sales surged 20.7% in March, which sent the iShares Home Construction ETF higher about 1.58%. But there was a drop in sales in the West, as well as a high proportion of homes that were sold for more than $400,000 a piece, which indicates there may be some pressures due to high prices and rising rates on home sales. Year over year, new home sales are up 66.8%. Existing home sales fell 3.7% in March, where the supply of existing homes remains at record low levels. And here too, prices are high because of the supply issues, creating affordability pressure. We had another weekly drop in jobless claims, down 39,000 to 547,000, supporting the recovery trend. And finally, the Confidence Board's leading economic index, which rose 1.3% in March, erasing the 1 month down in February after 9 consecutive increases. The biggest news out this week was Bloomberg's article on Thursday, which reported a new tax plan from the Biden administration would increase capital gains taxes on those earning $1 million or more, which would be increased to 43.4% when you add the Medicare surtax on top of that. Then there's state taxes depending on where you live. What's interesting is that previously in the day, an article was presented that didn't warrant the large reaction, I think it was the New York Times, that the Bloomberg article did. The S&P 500 went from 0.2% up for the day to down 1.2% in about an hour after the report was released from Bloomberg. On Friday, as we saw on Wednesday, the market bounced back in a buy-the-dip fashion. The reason traders gave for the optimistic undertone was an opinion the rate might be negotiated down. And markets historically have brushed tax increases off in previous bull markets. Finally, others were talking about strategies to work around the increase in taxes on capital gains. There were some notable earnings announcements this week, so let's focus on some of those. Coca-Cola, like Pepsi, reported better than expected results, though there are major differences between the two. Coke has about half of its revenues generated away from the home, while that segment only represents 10 to 20% of Pepsi's. So the idea of restaurants, sporting events, and other away-from-home venues where Coke has a majority stake, the company stands to benefit greatly from the economy opening up with fewer restrictions. They also said case volume recovered back to 2019 levels. The company reaffirmed its yearly outlook for high single-digit revenue growth and high single-digit to low double-digit earnings growth, which came in higher than Pepsi's estimates previously. The risk still weighs on its overseas sales as vaccine rollouts are more choppy and uneven overseas. With SAP reporting bullish guidance last week, that's SAP, hopes were high for Big Blue IBM, which has been increasingly shifting focus on cloud computing and artificial intelligence capabilities. While the growth rate of only 0.9% year-over-year for their revenue seems small, it was the best update since the second quarter of 2018, and previously the company had seen revenue declines in all but 1 year, from 2011 to 2020. So the focus to the higher margin business was a strategic accomplishment for the company, which also reported total cloud revenue of $6.5 billion, a small decline from the fourth quarter last year, but a 21% growth rate year over year. The company reaffirmed revenue growth expectations for 2021, but CEO Mr. Krishna sees cloud opportunity at $1 trillion with only 25% of workloads having moved to the cloud thus far, as he continues to make it a driving focus for the company. Shifting over to Netflix, which dropped 7.4% post-earnings as a result of missing the first quarter global net additions at 3.98 million versus guidance that was much more closer to 6 million. They've had a number of proprietary content pushed back as a result of shutdowns to the second half. The second negative came from the company's guidance at just 1 million subscribers next quarter. But given that number is so low, they have a good chance to beat it next quarter. Operating profit hit a record 27.4%, and to be fair with everything, Netflix had huge subscription additions a year ago at the onset of COVID that pulled forward a lot of demand. Now, United Airlines was hit pretty hard, down 8.5% on missing top and bottom line estimates, and probably due to the news that the U.S. State Department's Do Not Travel Advisory was increased to 80% of countries outside of the U.S. due to COVID. AT&T registered top-line growth for the first time since the second quarter of 2019 on wireless phone subscriptions and growth of its HBO Max streaming service. A lot of good news going on for the company there. Harley-Davidson rose 9.7% in earnings, and Equifax up 14.9% were other notable earnings winners this week, with Intel down 5.3% after beating earnings that were guided higher on March 23rd. So what's the deal? You know, Mobileye revenue was up, and there was a jump in PC unit volumes by 38%. The disappointment came from its data center group, where sales fell 20% last quarter, which was also worse than the previous quarter's decline. The company guided earnings higher, but it seems investors took profits, as despite the $20 billion planned expenditure to build out two new factories in Arizona, it seems the company's focus is a bit choppy with the decline in data center revenues and margins, and now the focus back towards legacy chip production. But that's it for this week's market report. Jim, back to you.
Since 2014, Dr. Alan Bollier at ITR Economics has been forecasting that the U.S. and the rest of the globe would experience another Great Depression in the 2030 timeframe. FS Insider caught up with him this week to discuss how investors should be thinking about this period and what they should be doing in response if their outlook is indeed correct. Here's a portion of that interview where he discussed how demographics are going to play a key role in this 2030 call.
Here in the United States and around the world, all of us baby boomers, we're going to, in this country, jump from 40 million of us on Medicare and prescription drugs and Social Security to 80 million of us. And as we transition out of the economy, we're going to become this major drain on the economy. Somebody's going to have to pay for that. Now, if borrowing is tougher because interest rates are higher, that means that they either say, sorry, older generation, you're not going to get your money, or they go to the Gen Xers and they go to the millennials and they go to Gen Z and go, sorry, we have to tax you more. We have to take care of our senior citizens. So at the same time, when costs are going up, taxes going up, and that's not a good prescription for economic growth.
To listen to this full 20-minute interview with Dr. Alan Bollier, where we discuss inflation, debt, and the key role modern monetary theory will play, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow at financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the top policies of the Biden administration is climate change. It's coming out here with a new program on infrastructure and the Green New Deal. Is this going to solve the problems of climate change? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program today is Mark Nelson. He's managing director at Radiant Energy Fund, an organization he founded to help protect nuclear plants around the world from closing. First of all, welcome to the program. I want to talk about climate change. You did a lot of research for a book out there called Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All by Michael Schellenberger. And in that, we talk about, and let me just read here from the book jacket and see if this starts our conversation. Despite decades of news media attention, many remain ignorant of basic facts. Carbon emissions peaked and have been declining in most of the developed nations for more than a decade. Deaths from extreme weather, even in poor nations, declined 80% over the last four decades. And the risk of the Earth warming to very high temperatures is increasingly unlikely thanks to slowing population growth. Yet, curiously, the people who are the most alarmist about the problems also tend to oppose the obvious solutions. So, let's begin with that. People are concerned. The Biden administration is concerned about climate change. And Michael, we hear a lot of alarmist rhetoric. You know, we're going to be dead in 10 years if we don't do something. And all these alarmist projections, are they really doing us any good? And is that really the situation we face going forward?
Jim, good to be on the show. It's clear from countries like Bangladesh, where it used to be that a decent-sized cyclone could kill a couple hundred thousand people in a single storm, now we're at a point where a country like Bangladesh, which by no means is super wealthy, and it's not yet the Netherlands of the Indian Ocean, but it is now to the point where a big typhoon or cyclone in that country will only kill a few people. And if we could just stop and think about that, we have a lot more carbon in the atmosphere. The best available science suggests that this could lead to possibly more erratic weather changes we might not even be able to predict. That gets turned into, we are going to die because of climate change, when the actual evidence shows that, even though we shouldn't rest on our laurels, We're getting better and better and better at protecting people around the world from the effects of this weather. So I think that that's worth thinking about, because a lot of people who have been protected from the weather for many decades, they've been comfortable much of their lives, they've got elite educations, they've got plenty of money, and they sit around and worry, and they sort of figure that they are the people who have to speak for the developing world that they don't even understand is getting safer and safer and safer from weather. Whether or not that weather is getting more severe, the impacts are dropping by orders of magnitude in terms of lives lost. I think that there could be a debate here about whether property damage without deaths is a good measure for storms getting worse. And I think that Apocalypse Never triggered a massive, intense debate going all the way into the deepest issues of, you know, censorship or not on Facebook and the internet over this issue of whether recoverable property damage is the same thing as people dying from weather, and whether we can separate those two things. Obviously, considering the research that I did to help Michael Schellenberger write Apocalypse Never, you can see what our answer is, which is protecting human lives, especially with systems that allow rapid recovery of the property damage, is the key thing for developing countries going forward. And if we can get that development right with the right technologies, it will even do a bunch of the heavy lifting to continue the wise path of lowering emissions through development around the world.
You know, I'm a big believer, Mark, in peak oil. Eventually, we're going to run out of the ability to support everything with, let's say, carbon things like oil. So going to renewable energy makes a lot of sense. My own house is solar powered. I'm getting Tesla batteries. But in Michael's TED Talks, he talks about wind and solar aren't necessarily the solutions. And certainly, as we saw in Texas, whether it was the wind turbines, the solar panels, or even the natural gas plants, something failed. And that reminds me, a good friend of mine, David Tice, has come out with a new documentary film called Grid Down, talking about the vulnerability of our electrical grid in terms of protecting it, whether it's a cyber hack or just updating the infrastructure. I want to talk about this green energy. If we're going to move in this direction and we're moving to EVs, I think there's going to be like 100 EVs announced this year by car manufacturers. Where are we going to get the dependable electricity to power these EVs? Because instead of at night, when the power consumption goes down, we now have our cars in the garage charging at night on the grid system.
Jim, you raise a bunch of interesting concerns, and I think clearly no one can accuse you of being a hater of solar if you've got it on your house. But I think the key thing here is to look at some recent case studies, California, Texas, and Germany. Now, California isn't quite its own grid like Texas and Germany are. And Texas is a bit more isolated from its neighboring grids than Germany is with its European neighbors. However, there's some other really good lessons that we can take from them to answer your question. So Germany's avoided some of the recent blackouts, small in California with a high probability of happening again, say this summer, and large in Texas with a, I would say, a lower probability of happening in the next year or two until the lessons wear off. It might be a year or two down the line before we have that again in Texas. But Germany has avoided these blackouts with something very clever and very specific. Over the last 20 years, Germany has built more than 100 gigawatts of capacity of solar and wind. And it's actually quite fascinating. A lot of German solar is on rooftops, just like you've got, Jim. But what Germany's done is, while it has spent a couple hundred billion euros on wind and solar capacity investments, it has actually raised, not lowered, its installed capacity of coal, diesel, and natural gas generators. I think we should stop and pause there just for a little bit of emphasis. Germany has successfully avoided the blackouts that we've seen start happening in California and Texas while having as much renewables as them. But they've done it by securing the life and operation of an even larger fossil fuel fleet than they had 20 years ago before they built out that wind and solar.
So here they've got a backup system. I know you're a big proponent of nuclear power. Why is it a lot of individuals in the environmental movement are against nuclear power? I mean, if you take a look at the number of accidents, yes, Chernobyl made it to Three Mile Island. I don't think anybody got hurt from that. But you hear about Fukushima, you hear about Chernobyl. And so I know in my own state of California, we've shut down our nuclear power plants. So let's talk about that. Why are environmentalists against nuclear power?
Great question, Jim. And before I just come out with a direct answer, I think there's a few really key myths to dispel. One, there's a myth that Three Mile Island meltdown and then Hiroshima meltdown caused the anti-nuclear movement. This is false. It was the large, strong, and incredibly powerful anti-nuclear cultural and elite environmentalist movement that reframed the meaning of those accidents as being some threat to the environment or some giant multi-generational threat to people. Okay, so let's just repeat that. The reason why we think of Three Mile Island as a dangerous disaster, despite its lack of radiation exposure to the public or to workers, and despite the continued decades-long good operation of Three Mile Island nuclear plant, the reason we think of it as a disaster is because a very strong anti-nuclear movement called it one, made a disaster, and ballooned the effects and impact of that event far beyond any physical reality. Was it good that an expensive piece of plant equipment was lost out of control and then was lost to future generations that needed its clean energy? No, that's not good. That's no apology. Nuclear industry has worked for decades to get its act together, as has the, say, the airline industry. But what's important to know is that the framing of that as some key milestone event comes out of an existing anti-nuclear movement. Here's another thing. The early environmental movement, so the 50s and 60s, especially in California, actually had some of its most important leaders and spiritual founders pro-nuclear because, as they argued, California was going to need energy to develop and much better to have it with nuclear than with coal and gas. This was sort of the generation that, you know, fought in World War II. They had they grew up in the Great Depression. They had a very keen sense of the facts of life, the need to provide, the fact that people would do just about anything to feed their family, and it's best to make it to where the impacts of this development, this human flourishing, was as low as possible. This was the generation of California environmentalists like Ansel Adams and his peers who really developed the Sierra Club. They were the ones who worked to get nuclear sited properly in the state so California could get the energy it needs. There was a new rebellious younger generation that came up after them, the counterculture that made a tie between big nuclear and corporate power and the military and all these bad things. You know, it was kind of against the coming global revolution that was going to bring new consciousness. Anyway, that movement was the one that was attacking nuclear heavily even before the first accident. So it's important to note that that generation in many cases is still alive, still out there, still kicking. Rocky Mountain Institute, I've never met a young person who works there who understood the role of Rocky Mountain Institute in pushing coal, especially burning wood and stuff in homes, as an alternative to having nuclear plants. They always say, oh, well, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. I'll ask my boss. And then the answer always comes back down, no, we're not going to talk about nuclear. And these are giant, extremely rich, long-lived environmental foundations. Their concern with stopping nuclear long predates any concern about carbon, Jim. So I think it's important to get that clear. Nuclear plants were being stopped, halted, and shut down before Three Mile Island, and that the concern of environmental NGOs about carbon is extremely late, and it is half-hearted compared to the concern with stopping nuclear. Another few anecdotes. I've worked around the country to try to stop these nuclear plants from closing. We are almost always going up against nine-digit funded per year, like nine-digit per year budget, environmental NGOs, many of them based out of California, that will always put carbon second if it means the ability to keep closing nuclear.
You know, it just amazes me. I have an EV vehicle on order. So not only do I have solar, I have batteries that I'm ordering, and then I'm going to have an EV car, and eventually my wife will have one as well. And I just think about, you know, Mark, it's not just that I'm going to be driving around an electric vehicle, I'm going to be charging it at night, but also, you know, in place of gas stations, we are going to start opening up charging stations all around the country, because if you want to travel anywhere, you've got to have access to energy just like you do putting gas in your tank. Where the heck is all this energy going to come from?
Easy. It's going to come from plants that can be counted on to put out power whenever users drive up. So let's just say there's a optimist vision and a pessimist vision here. The pessimist vision is that we lose our reliable energy sources, and then we put extremely strict time and quantity rationing controls on everybody. So for example, because in California, solar output is significantly less for 4 or 5 months of the year than it is in the other 4 or 5 months, it may be that we just have to tell people, this is the winter season. You need every driver to cut their driving by 40% because that's the amount of energy we're not getting, right? So now you might say, no, in the winter, we'll have wind turbines offshore. Yeah, but there can be week or 2 week periods where there's almost no wind offshore. And that can, of course, occur in the winter. So you tell people you need to be ready to do 40% less driving all winter. Oh, and plus, we don't know which weeks they're going to be. There's going to be a few weeks where we just have to shut down the state and go back into lockdown because we're not going to be able to have you drive. So that's the pessimist vision, I suppose. You could alter that and say, oh, it'll just stop clean cars. There will be some big week or 2 week long shortage or blackout that convinces everyone that the electric car idea wasn't a good idea, and they switch back to the next generation of, you know, efficient or whatever, diesel or gasoline internal combustion vehicles. Well, that's another devolving storyline, but let's stay away from that. Let's look at the optimistic case and then say how the optimistic case could go wrong or it could go right here, Jim. So here's the optimistic case. People get electric cars and they fill it up with electricity when they roll up to either their house or to a charging station. Where does that energy come from? It comes from reliable energy. Where does that come from? Well, natural gas, unless you have an extreme shortage like in the Texas blackouts, or nuclear, some hydro. Of course, hydro is it's another somewhat climate-dependent energy. Some years you have hydro and some years you don't. You know, kind of live by the rain, die by the rain. Certainly in California, we have a bad hydro year. It's making renewables look better this year because we're not having to throw out as much of their power as we did last April. But on the other hand, it means we're not going to have enough water for the state. So it's a bit of a risky thing. That means that energy is going to come from those natural gas plants or from the nuclear plants in the bulk sense. Here's the pessimistic view of the optimistic view. And this is what California is currently doing. It's what the environmental NGOs are pushing for. It's what the highest level politicians are pushing for. It's what everybody, it seems, in a position of authority in California is locked into. That's protecting all the fossil fuels, installing even more diesel generators, and getting rid of the nuclear. And then what's going to happen is those same people are going to charge their cars, and it's going to be with natural gas if it's a day that the grid doesn't go down.
Well, it's amazing. Being a sailor, there are often times I've gone out sailing, there's no wind, or I've gone out sailing and the sun isn't out because it's cloudy. So we're talking about two intermittent sources of power, both wind and solar. You've got to have a backup system or something stable, whether it's a natural gas plant or a nuclear plant. And can we build enough natural gas plants to make up what we could do with just one nuclear power plant?
In the broader sense, yeah, just build a bunch of natural gas plants and hope that there isn't peak gas, right? So then in the more specific case, it's not clear we can build much of anything in California at all. What's so interesting about the emergency diesel generator permissions that seem to be coming down the line from our state regulators is that it kind of reveals that there are no climate hawks in a foxhole. And in California, the CPUC, they've got this super progressive language. They say they open their meetings and say, you know, we just really love all the people and everybody's great and everything. Let's go fight for the climate. But today's agenda, we're going to approve some emergency fossil fuels and backup batteries, because that's just, you know, I mean, we'll get to the climate tomorrow. We've got to make sure the grid doesn't go down. Now, that's correct, except for this is the same connected groups of, you know, politically connected appointees and the people who appoint them who arranged for this crisis in the first place by intentionally choosing to kill the nuclear plants first as the most important thing they could do with their time, energy, and effort, if that makes sense.
Well, it just reminds me, Mark, of even with this COVID crisis, the lockdowns really didn't accomplish anything other than to harm the economy. We're almost doing the same thing when it comes to the environmental movement. I'm a sailor. I'm very concerned about, you know, the ocean, pollutions of the ocean. And like I say, I ordered an electric car. My house is solar powered. I'm doing all the things I can do. But, and that's because living in California over the last couple of decades, I've gone through a number of power outs where, you know, being in the financial business, you can't run a business when your power goes down and you have no access to the markets.
Can I comment on this sailing thing?
Sure.
So the big idea is that, oh, no, we're going to do a type of power that the USA hasn't done yet and Europe has. That's going to be offshore wind. So when you ask what we can build, let's just be clear that the point that we're talking about establishing a new offshore wind industry, we're talking about costs on the same order of even difficult, prolonged, bungled, mismanaged, chaotic nuclear build. Okay, so I've seen different cost projections for what the final delivered cost of the new two units, the only two new nuclear reactors under construction in the United States, in Georgia, at Vogtle, Plant Vogtle. These are two reactors, and the final cost appears that it's going to be somewhere from $70 to $110. This is called a LCOE, levelized cost of energy in this case, to get these plants up and running. And that was because half the companies involved, the won bids, didn't know how to build any nuclear. We had to retrain a whole workforce. A bunch of companies went bankrupt and tapped out before we finally called Bechtel, one of the only, you know, here in California, one of the only companies that truly retained in living memory how to build a nuclear plant properly. So it was a real wreck of a project in many ways, except that when it's up and running, it's going to last for a century, for very cheap energy for a century, once we pay off the cost of construction. The offshore wind that we're deciding is going to be the future, not only will we not be able to rely on it any more than a sailor can always rely on just sails to get around, but the cost of doing it financially is going to be, over a long period of time, much higher than the nuclear, over the lifetime of the first set of projects, about the same. It's also going to industrialize the continental shelf in a way that every single one of these big California environmental organizations should be screaming about. And do you know what, Jim? They are absolutely silent.
You know, the amazing thing is, you take a look at this whole process. We want to move in one direction, which is, you know, get away from fossil fuels, go to more renewable energy. And we're talking about everybody getting EVs. You see one car manufacturer after another. As I mentioned, there's going to be like 100 new EV vehicles introduced this year. You have some companies like Volkswagen and others that are saying, we're not even going to make gas cars in the future. You even got Detroit moving in that direction. But nobody has thought through, I think, the power consumption that is going to be necessary if we're all driving around in EVs. It's kind of like the
policy. I will say, Jim, that fortunately, at least with EVs, I'm not saying we're all going to switch to them, but at least with EVs, there's fairly compelling physical reasons why it works for a consumer who doesn't give a damn about the environment. It, you know, they accelerate fast. There's advantages with using motors. Like, we don't have to go into all the numbers here, but there's at least compelling reasons why an electric vehicle could work. I will say this. There are people who would take exception with what you said, that nobody's looked into it. A lot of people claim to have looked into it, and they're assuming that things like vehicle to grid powering is just going to work when almost all the people that I talk to say, oh, this is bad. Consumers are going to hate it. You have a massive decrease in efficiency in your total energy system. Even if you think it's going to save you some money on generation, it's going to damage the vehicles unless you limit the draw rate and the draw depth. You know, it's going to all these things. So vehicle to grid, let's just put that aside for a moment. It's clear that in countries that are going to these vehicles, they will do whatever it takes in the end, if they're technologically and politically capable of keeping the grid up. It's just in places like California, it's not clear that they're capable of keeping the grid up. We'd know because they'd commit to reopening Diablo. It's already got all the upgrades it needs for another 40 years. Yeah. But in Germany, where they have a very keen sense of the role of engineering and political decision making, except for the nuclear phase out, they are keeping their fossil fuel plants to be able to power these electric vehicles.
Yeah, you're going to have to, because you just imagine, you know, if we really start making this conversion to EVs, the pressure it's going to put on the grid system itself. So what has been the reaction to Michael's book? I mean, he's a prominent environmentalist, and especially in California, he's been involved. He was actually on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. When I saw his TED Talk, it really struck me. Here's a prominent environmentalist that's talking about there's a better way to go about this. And by the way, we're not all going to die. Things have actually improved, as you pointed out, in Bangladesh.
So, Jim, here's an interesting one of the most interesting fight backs is from, not to bring racial politics onto your show, other elite white people, journalists, and environmental NGO folks who accused Michael of promoting white supremacist energy sources like dams and nuclear plants, when what developing countries really want is the type of energy sources that rich countries would never dream of only building. You know, let me just give you a few more anecdotes that are unfolding stories that we're going to look at. There are countries out there that might be willing to get solar and wind deals done with a place like Germany, but they're insisting on being able to build it for themselves because none of the permanent jobs are in operating these facilities. They're all in getting the technology and building it for yourself. Germany appears, and the EU in general, appear to be heavily resisting other countries actually getting the factory jobs, which of course ties back to the fact that Germany's internal viewpoint, this is what I've heard from German people on the street and policymakers, is that Germans have sacrificed for the world by converting a little bit of their fossil fuel output to being some renewables. And so it's only right and just that Germans, with their superior organizational capabilities and advanced technologies, they're going to just keep doing the pollution. It's okay. They've done their part, you know, by showing leadership. They will keep the jobs. They will keep the consultants. They will keep the factories powered all night and all day by fossil fuels to sell to the simple, basic, innocent world, solar and wind. So because Michael's book upended that narrative, people lashed back out calling him an imperialist or any word in the book they could think to escape the fact that the environmental movement is almost totally, at least in terms of what we can tell by what they do, I'd be interested in knowing more about their financing specifics, but the environmental industry has almost completely sold out the environment on every level to get only energy sources that necessarily require taking and destroying wilderness and displacing farming land and species, if that makes sense. So the response to his book was furious. Now, here's another response to a book. After an attempt to kind of cancel the book, it didn't go well. Certainly, there's a lot of folks who probably don't agree with at least me on protecting the environment. I mean, it's hard to impute motives, but I know that there were a lot of people who used Michael's book with glee because they said, ha, here's a weapon to bludgeon our enemies. But Michael's coming at this, they're saying, you've got to protect the environment. If your energy plan doesn't protect the environment, it's not environmental progress. It's not worthy of the name. And if you defend attacking the environment by saying there's a more critical environmental and human challenge than protecting the environment, at least you should be out and honest. And furthermore, the data appears to disagree with that, as we talked about at the beginning. So here's another very dark part of the pushback to Michael's book. We had people saying, Michael is making a bad argument. Bangladesh can never be Netherlands because Netherlands is special and and developed and rich. And of course, you see, we're getting into dangerous territory, Jim, where we say, why can't Bangladesh be Netherlands? What is it about Bangladesh? They're both super low countries. Is it that Bangladesh has a ton of people? I don't know. Their population densities aren't super different. Are we saying that Bangladesh engineers are just not smart? Or are we saying that their politics can never get it done? What are we really saying about Bangladesh when we say that the experience of the Dutch building and maintaining their own nuclear plant and now looking to even expand it is not appropriate? What's good for the Dutch is white supremacist for the folks in Bangladesh. Fortunately, what the response that Michael's getting from the rest of the world is incredibly positive. The book is coming out in 17 different languages. 17 languages, Jim. Why? Because the people who need energy need a story, need a way to show that just because they want to provide for their family doesn't mean they want to destroy their own country's environment. Furthermore, it means they don't have to. And that story is in Apocalypse Never.
Well, super. Well, listen, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Like I said, I saw Michael's TED Talk, and it was very impressive. And being somewhat of an environmentalist myself, well, you know, that comes from just sailing, seeing the pollution of the oceans, and then also actually implementing that with solar EVs and things of that nature. I wanted to have you on the program. I want to thank you for coming on the program. And once again, the book that we've been talking about, which Mark helped do the research, is called Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All by Michael Schellenberger. And we've been speaking with Mark. So, Mark, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Keep up the great work you're doing at Radiant Energy. Hopefully, we can preserve some of these nuclear power plants so we don't get into rolling blackouts, which
Jim, can I just, I'm sorry to interrupt your closing, but I'm saying you're in California. If you've got listeners in California, they need to contact their representatives. They need to contact the NRDC, Environmental Defense Fund. They need to contact the Sierra Club and say, we see what you're doing. We know you know that what you're doing is wrong for the state. You must know that there will be a price to pay for sending us directly to rolling blackouts and higher emissions just to satisfy your old vendettas.
Well, I'm going to take you up on that because we're going to have, hopefully, David Tice with his new documentary film, Grid Down. He points out to some of the dangers that we've been discussing here. But once again, Mark, thanks so much for coming on the program. Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jim.
Why do you think crypto should be part of a diversified portfolio?
Just look at the Sharpe ratio. Yes, the volatility is horrendous, and I say that affectionately about Bitcoin. It's horrible for a lot of people that just don't understand it. But the Sharpe ratio, you know, what's your return for the volatility? From that perspective, Bitcoin is a superior asset. It just sounds crazy, but that it has returned on a risk basis above and beyond anything.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Big Picture on the return of inflation and the bull market of the century. Today, we're going to discuss where we're seeing the biggest price increases, how government policy is going to drive inflation higher, and how we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are investing around both the risks and opportunities this presents for investors. So, Jim, let's start with inflation. Where are we seeing the biggest price increases currently, and what's your outlook on the longer-term trend?
Well, let's just take a look at what has happened to prices that people are actually experiencing on Main Street. If we take a look at the PPI, was up 1% in March. That's the largest gain, Chris, in 9.5 years. It's up 4.2% over the last 12 months. If you take a look at March CPI, it was up 0.6%. CPI has been rising since last October. It's up 2.6% over the last 12 months. You take a look at the CRB index, up 82%. Lumber prices up 287%. West Texas Intermediate crude up almost 400%. And here's a key one. Copper up 85%. Corn 68%. If you look at the agricultural ETF, DBA, it's up 35%. And it's just not these commodity prices, Chris. We're seeing anecdotal stories. The Wall Street Journal did a story about China plans to raise prices 7%. The Chinese manufacturers citing higher raw material costs and higher transportation costs. Procter & Gamble this week said that this September they're raising prices across the board on all products from diapers to toilet paper. So these are the kind of things that you're seeing right now. It's being reflected at the gas pump. You're seeing it when you go to stores buying food. I mean, just take a look at your food prices. So this is all building momentum.
And obviously, government policy is directly pursuing this. If you listen to the Fed and if you listen to Jerome Powell, Fed chair, he's saying, you know, their target is for not just 2% inflation, but to get above 2%. So this is all currently, when we look at this, this is all within the purview of what they're pursuing as part of their monetary policy.
Yeah, and if you just take a look at the different policies, one of them was the lockdown that a lot of these governors use. Well, when you're going through lockdown, you're putting a lot of people out of business. You're cutting the supply chain. You're cutting services. So at the same time, the government is destroying or killing off businesses. They're also increasing incentives to not work. One of the persistent stories that you're seeing in the Wall Street Journal is about, you know, restaurant owners, service businesses that are just crying for labor. I don't know what it's like where you live, Chris, but around our neighborhood, you drive around the shopping centers, you know, whether it's fast food restaurants, you're seeing help wanted, help wanted. Well, why in the hell are you going to go work when you can make more money not working? In addition to cutting the supply of goods and services, the government at the same time is using helicopter drops, giving people money to buy those goods and services. Then there's also a big push to drive unionization. So the thing that's happening that we're seeing for the first time and what's going to characterize, I would say, this time around coming out of a crisis versus, let's say, going back to 2008, as we've talked about, when the Fed creates money, there's three places it can go. It can go into cash. If people don't feel good about spending money, maybe they're a little bit apprehensive about their own jobs. For example, if we go back to this time last year when everything was being shut down, you know, a lot of people, we gave them money with the stimulus program, but a lot of people just said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to have work. So it can go in cash, it could go in the economy, or it can go into financial markets. Now, in the 00 decade, in the last decade, the vast majority of Fed money creation went into the financial market. So we had financial market inflation. So past cycles, financial assets were the main recipient of Fed largesse. Now, what we're seeing is a different type. You're seeing the fusion of fiscal and monetary policy. And what the government is actually doing is they are injecting money directly into the economy, either consumers or they're injecting that money with state governments. So that's a big difference this time around, where the government is actually getting involved, because in the 2008 financial crisis, the bulk of that money the Fed created either went in the financial markets or it stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. That's not happening this time around.
So commodity prices are up big time. We're either near all-time highs or at new all-time highs on a number of different commodities. As we mentioned, government policy is in direct pursuit of higher inflation, and there's many ways in which this can work into either the economy or the financial markets, both of which we're seeing currently and which we are taking advantage of at our firm, Financial Sense Wealth Management. But why do you think this current bout of inflation will not be transitory,
as many people are debating right now, but more structural in nature?
Well, you know, one of the big debates right now, and this is the viewpoint coming from the Fed, that any inflation that we see is just strictly going to be temporary. In other words, as the economy restarts after the shutdown with COVID, that we'll see an initial bout of inflation, but it'll be transitory. And that's because, you know, they cite, look, the last 4 or 5 decades, you know, we had money printing, but we didn't have inflation. We were in a disinflationary environment. And we did a show on this, why there wasn't inflation, I think, a couple months ago. But it's worth repeating. One of the reasons we did not see inflation, if you take a look at the 70s, when we had double-digit inflation, I think we got up to like 14 or 15%. What happened as a result of the 70s, as a result of inflation, moms went to work. So you had women coming into the workforce, which created a larger labor pool. In addition to that, we started opening up with globalization, emerging markets. So you had lower cost labor in Mexico and China, Cambodia, Vietnam, the Asian countries. And that helped to bring down and suppress the cost of labor. So we didn't see the labor inflation. One of the big problems that we've had is wages have been stagnant. Part of it is competing labor forces around the globe. The second thing that brought down prices was globalization and offshoring manufacturing. Just take a look at anything you own today. You buy it in a store, your clothing, your gym equipment, or anything else, it's made in China. And as a result of globalization and increase of the labor pool, what happened, it was the decline of labor unions. And then the fourth factor that was driving down prices was technology. Now let's take a look at what the macro forces are going into place that's going to change this. Number one, instead of a growing labor pool, we're going to have aging populations and the reversal of demographic trends. And that, Chris, is one of the biggest macro drivers that's going to drive wage inflation going forward. Number two, we've talked about this several years ago, the concentration and monopoly power. If you take a look at every industry, whether it's airlines, whether it's big box stores, retail, everything is consolidating and it's concentrating in fewer hands. And this goes back to Warren Buffett's philosophy, where he likes what he calls economic moats. Basically, what Buffett likes are oligopolies and monopolies, companies that have pricing power. And you're seeing this in Amazon. I don't know if you've checked prices. I used to go to Amazon because that was probably the easiest way to buy something, and it was also cheaper. I don't do that anymore because Amazon doesn't necessarily have the cheapest prices anymore. So as more and more companies get bought out, as one industry after another consolidates, what happens? When you consolidate, you get rid of your competition. You get rid of your competition, that gives you pricing power and higher margins. So basically, concentration and monopoly power. Number three, the reverse of globalization. There's an anti-globalization movement. We saw that not only here with Trump, but we saw it in Europe, and also the rise of populism. And then the other thing that we're seeing right now that we're going to go more into depth over the next year over this subject is unsustainable spending, the rise in debt, which will lead to eventually what we're predicting will come a collapse of the dollar and a dollar devaluation. So those are, Chris, probably the big four macro forces that are going to drive inflation going forward this decade.
This week on FS Insider, we spoke with Dr. Alan Bollier at ITR Economics. They have a 2030 Great Depression call in place. And one of the key parts about that was what you just touched upon on the macro inflation forces related to demographics. And as he pointed out, we have about 40 million baby boomers that are moving in retirement right now. As we get closer to 2030, that number is going to double to about 80 million. So you're going to have a massive amount of people drawing on Social Security, on Medicare, paying for prescription drugs. And if you think the debts are high now, just wait until we start getting a little bit closer to 2030. So that is a long-term thing to keep in mind. And as you mentioned, that does relate to what the government is likely to do in the face of this demographic trend, which is to devalue the dollar.
You know, it's amazing, too, because along these trends, we interviewed Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Brown University, who's an expert on Social Security and Medicare. And we're going to play that interview. You want to catch it. It'll be on Lifetime Planning on Monday. But he talked about Social Security and Medicare right now has $53 trillion of unfunded liabilities. And if you take Medicare, Social Security, government pensions, it's $163 trillion of unfunded liabilities. It's unsustainable. So that's part of this unsustainable spending, which will eventually lead to this dollar collapse and devaluation. So it's not just one or two very sharp people that are talking and seeing this trend in the future, but a lot more people are picking up on it.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as we've discussed, Richard Cilla, he's the famed economist that wrote basically the book on the history of interest rates. He said, when you spoke with him, I believe this was last year, get prepared for rising inflation. Also, Dr. Woody Brock, another eminent economist, talking about how he expects structural inflation. And obviously, investors need to be preparing for that, as we have been doing now in positioning towards commodities and other asset classes that do well during an inflationary cycle.
Yeah, and if you take a look at the sequence that leads to devaluation, we've seen this over and over again. Even when, for example, we were doing well with the economy in the Trump administration, Trump was running trillion-dollar deficits. When the economy was doing well and the unemployment rate was the lowest it was in more than half a century. So even before the pandemic, the U.S. was running trillion-dollar deficits. Now, the last year of the Trump administration, the deficit was 3.1. It's anticipated this year under Biden, it could be $4 trillion. Next year, $5 trillion. The CBO predicts that deficits will start running 16% of GDP going forward in this decade. So eventually, at some point, we're going to get to weakness because inflation will start driving interest rates. The Fed is going to be forced to respond. And if you look at the sequence for a devaluation, and let's take the way it occurred between 1929 and 1933, it begins with the stock market crash, which leads eventually to a recession or depression. And then what you see is a massive physical and monetary response, and that is followed by devaluation. So if you look at 1929, we had a stock market crash over the next 3 years. The stock market lost 90% of its value. Hoover lost the election. Roosevelt comes in. The first week of his administration, he devalues the dollar against gold, ends deflation immediately. But it was a dollar devaluation that followed a stock market crash and a depression. So imagine the money that we're spending right now. This year, the stimulus is going to be somewhere, who knows, in the neighborhood of $5, $6, $7 trillion. They keep banding about these numbers. It keeps changing almost every single week. But let's say it's $4 to $5 trillion. You start throwing that kind of money at the economy, it's going to drive inflationary forces.
Yeah. And so as we've discussed on our program many times in the past, now that we're looking at modern monetary theory as essentially the policy du jour on both sides of the aisle, and I would say that structural forces or the system currently necessitates that type because no one's going to take the pain now. They're just going to push that off and paper it over as much as possible. So we're going to see continued money printing. The debt is not going to be paid down. But with that, we should expect higher inflation and, in accordance with modern monetary theory policy, higher taxes as well.
Take a look at this week in the market. Market responding, Biden would raise capital gains taxes to 44% for upper income Americans. And also on top of that, that would be the same on dividends. So if you're an upper income American, you would no longer get favorable capital gains or dividend tax treatment. And so you take a look at states like it was on the financial news this morning. Some of the governors in states like California, my own state, and New York are crying out, don't do this, because if you raise capital gains taxes to 44% in New York, which just raised income taxes to 16%, Chris, add 16% to 44%, you're talking 60% confiscatory
taxation of capital gains. What do you think people are going to do? They're going to leave. So you may not be able to do anything about your federal taxes, but you can do something about your state taxes. And that's why a lot of people, we've had some of these people on the show, are saying this is going to create the largest migration that we've seen in U.S. history. Is, you know, Florida is a big recipient of it. Texas, a big recipient. Arizona, a big recipient. Nevada, Wyoming, Washington, all these tax-free states. And the other thing is, if they do follow through with these taxations, we could be looking at a severe bear market later on this year that heads into the next couple of years. And then once again, a policy response. We tried this with Clinton. In 93, he raised capital gains rates to 28%. We had a stock market sell-off in 94, and then, of course, a change in political outcomes in Washington, and they reversed that 28% and dropped it back down to 20. So they may go after 44% initially, but when they see what it does to the economy and the markets, that may be reversed. But nonetheless, that's on the agenda right now.
And when it comes to these long-term risks of both inflation and increasing taxes, this is where it's really important to have a financial planner to work with you. And we provide that with comprehensive financial plans. We look at your portfolio, we look at your asset mix, and see how things can be structured in a way to both reduce your tax burden legally, of course, and then also to structure your portfolio in such a way where you're going to benefit from an increasing inflationary environment rather than just getting hit by it, which most people do if they do not take action. So I think that's a really important thing to point out. And along those lines, Jim, you know, one thing that we've been discussing is a commodity super cycle. And I know you're a big time commodity investor. You're very exposed to this area. We have been increasingly exposing our clients to key commodities, to key commodity mining companies. So tell us about some of the investment implications that stem from this.
One of the things that really stands out, you're seeing it in some of the price increases we talked about in commodities. We believe we're in a commodity super cycle in this decade, and it's going to have two main drivers. Number one, the green economy, and number two, inflation. So let's talk about the green economy. You can't talk about the green economy without talking about copper, which is, as Goldman Sachs says, the new oil, silver, nickel, and oil itself. So if we take a look at what happened this week, there was a climate summit. President Biden said he wants to reduce carbon emissions by 50% by 2030. Well, how are you going to do that? You're going to have to do that either through abatement, electrification, or renewable energy. And what that means is copper demand is going to go up anywhere from 600 to 900%, according to Goldman Sachs, in the next decade. And it's not just it's going to go up. As you have this huge demand that's going to come in for copper, and we'll get into that in just a second, you got to understand that to bring a new copper mine into production sometimes takes 7 to 10 years. So even though they're anticipating shortages of copper, mine supply is not going to be quick to come in and make up the difference or substitution, because it takes 7 to 10 years from greenfield discovery to bring a mine into production. So there are long lead times for new mines. And if we look at basically why copper, if you take a look at some of the key things of copper, it has so many things going for it. Number one, it's ductility. In other words, you can roll copper into sheets and make wires without breaking. Electrical conductivity, thermal conductivity, and low reactivity. So it's the ideal metal that's used in electrification. If you take a look at copper uses, let's just take a look at, for example, wind turbines. Copper demand from wind energy is going to account for almost 20% of green demand. Electric vehicles. Electric vehicles use five times the amount of copper that you use in a gas-driven engine. Solar panels. So if you take a look at the performance of solar panels, you not only need silver, but you also need copper for wiring, energy storage. And Chris, if we're going to also go to electric vehicles, think of electric charging stations. For example, a level one and two charging ports contain one and 7 kilograms of copper for a charge. So it's not just the electric vehicles that you're driving, it's also going to be the charging stations. So eventually, you're going to see the nation populated with charging stations, just as you see today across the country, gas stations. So copper is a key part of that. Silver, you can't do solar panels without silver. Nickel for batteries. And we can get in to all the amount of demand that's going to be coming in as we go towards this green economy. Now, the other one that's going to be a big investment, and I've gone on record here, I thought we were going to see an higher oil prices, but I also think we're going to have an oil crunch mid-decade. And that's because since 2014, oil companies have pulled back on investments. We even have a movement on Wall Street to intervene with the big oil companies and get them to divest of their oil investments, which is probably the dumbest thing I've ever seen, because we're going to need that oil to carry us through this transition until we get to this green economy. You're still going to have cars that are driving on gasoline or diesel. You're going to have trucks. You're going to have trains. You're going to have planes. You're going to have, you know, ships that bring us the goods in the surface. So it's the green economy is not going to happen overnight. It's going to accelerate in this decade, which is going to drive the demand for raw materials. But still, you're still going to need oil in this transition. So that's why we are extremely bullish on the commodity sector. And I think this is going to be one of the biggest super cycles in commodities, or the bull market of a century.
And of course, you know, when we're talking about investing in commodities and commodity related companies, this is a volatile sector. And so you really do want to do your due diligence on which companies have the best fundamentals and have key support and resistance areas that you're watching, and follow a strict risk management process. And these are all the things that we do at Financial Sense Wealth Management as part of our investment services. So these are some things that you really need to follow closely if you're investing in this sector. But again, for the long term, we believe, given how, as we discussed, fiscal and monetary policy is both now a major tailwind for higher inflation, they're in direct pursuit of that, in combination with the switch to green energy. These are all major tailwinds for not just higher commodity prices, but for those select commodities that are also geared towards green energy. So, Jim, with all that said, that nice disclaimer there, what are some lasting thoughts you'd like to leave with our audience when it comes to the investment implications around what we discussed today?
Number one, if you're investing in precious metals, get physical. Right now, there's a massive short position in silver, so there's huge premiums on Silver Eagles, Maple Leafs, Philharmonics, etc. But, you know, you want to have some silver bullion. We love the commodity producers, Chris. I mean, we're all in when it comes to that. Things like real estate, but residential real estate versus commercial. I think commercial has been hit hard with COVID-19, as many companies around the country have decided, hey, we don't need all this office space. And you've seen from large companies, they're saying, you know what? We're going to get rid of a lot of the space. We just don't need it. People can work remotely. I mean, if you're a coder working at Amazon, one of my best friend's son is high up on the level of Amazon, and he writes a lot of code for Alexa. You know, he works remotely. So, you know, you don't need those big buildings anymore. But residential, they can't build enough homes. There's a shortage of homes. Probably the best seller's market in real estate that I've probably seen in my lifetime. So all those investment implications, you want to get invested in this area. You're going to want to own a combination of not only stocks of the producers, but also the bullion itself.
As always, if you'd like to speak with any of our advisors at Financial Sense Wealth Management about what we discussed today, or to implement a comprehensive financial plan looking at your portfolio, your assets, and how you can invest in inflation-protected securities or in assets that do well in an increasing inflationary environment, feel free to give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or you can also email us at grow@financialsense.com.
As a result of what we see, this Nelly commodity super cycle that we see unfolding over the next decade, and then also the inflationary aspects, we're developing two new accounts that I'm working with Frank Barbera. One will be an inflation account where at any one time, there's always one sector of the commodity markets that are moving. It could be oil, it could be gold, it could be the ags, it could be base metals, or it could actually be foreign currency. You don't know where money's going to flow in reaction to higher inflationary forces. So this is going to give us the flexibility to weave in and out of these various sectors. And then finally, as this bull market begins to heat up in precious metals, we're going to be starting another gold fund. We had one in the 00 decade that we closed out when the bull market ended in 2011. But we're starting that up again. And these are two things that we hope to come out with by the end of the year to help us transition and manage money into this commodity super cycle we see unfolding over the next decade. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to wish you a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.